I call the Division on Long-Term Care to order. Members, we have a lot to do today, and as you can tell, I'm losing my voice, so let's see how long I last. We're going to bring some bills back and amend some bills and then send them to HHS Finance. So the first bill we're going to take up is House File 168. This is the Disability Waiver Rate System Modified. We had put on an amendment last time it was in front of us, the A2 amendment. So it's in the packets, and we have another amendment that is being passed out. It's the A3 amendment. So I'm going to offer the A3 amendment to House File 168. This is the commissioner in consultation with stakeholders shall study value-based models and outcome-based payment strategies for fee-for-service home and community-based services and report to the legislative committees with jurisdictions over the disability waiver rate system with recommended strategies to improve the quality, efficiency, and effectiveness of services. Do we have anybody that would like to testify to the amendment? Just state your name for the committee. Welcome, and then proceed, please.
Thank you, Chair Schultz, members of the committee. My name is Juliana Keene. I am with Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. Thank you, Chair Schultz, for introducing this amendment and to the committee for all of your work. I have handouts here. This could be passed out. Thank you. This amendment is language that's included in the governor's budget that directs DHS to study value-based payment models and disability services. It's also a standalone bill with bipartisan support that has broad support from the disability community, including ARM, MORE, the Minnesota Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities, as well as the 12 organizations you see listed on your handout. Our current system under the Disability Waiver Rate Setting Tool is a fee-for-service in which payments are made for a service or unit of service that's delivered, and where payments vary based on unit of service. While it's essential for the stability of disability services to pass House File 168 as we face the biggest workforce crisis we have ever experienced, at the same time, we're continuing to prepare for the future of disability services. People's lives are more complicated than the fee-for-service model. Value-based models in home and community-based services would look at models that pay based on value and hold providers accountable for what they're paid for. It will promote effective approaches to housing, employment, and healthcare integration. Moving toward these alternative payment models has the potential to help Minnesota improve the health and quality of life of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities while potentially lowering per-person costs. CMS is increasingly moving in the direction of value-based, outcome-based models with varying results for people with disabilities, and we want to ensure that Minnesota does what is best for Minnesotans. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you. Are there members, does any member have a question for the testifier or about the amendment? Would anyone else like to testify? Okay, seeing none. So the motion is to adopt the A3 amendment to House File 168. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, amendment adopted. So the next motion is to move House File 168 as amended to be re-referred to Health and Human Services Finance. Discussion. Any discussion? That motion. Any testifiers? Okay, so all in favor of the motion to re-refer House File 168 as amended to Health and Human Services Finance, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, motion passes. Okay, the next bill is House File 763 as amended. What amendment number is that? I think it's the A1 amendment. That should be in your packets. Members, we discussed this last week. I'm going to make a motion to re-refer House File 763 as amended to Health and Human Services Finance. Any discussion to that motion? It was a DE1 amendment. Okay, so the motion is to re-refer House File 763 as amended with the DE1 amendment to Health and Human Services Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. Motion passes. The next bill we're going to bring up is House File 1046. This is the medical assistance income limit for elderly, blind, and disabled, as amended. As amended with the DE1. I'm going to move that House File 1046, as amended, be referred to Health and Human Services Finance. Any discussion? No discussion? Okay. All in favor of the motion to be referred House File 1046 as amended to Health and Human Services Finance, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, motion passes. And members, we're doing this because we're not going to do a division report. It's going to be simpler for our staff just to send up these files individually to Health and Human Services Finance. Okay, the next bill on the agenda is House File 2244. Representative Cleburne. Okay, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I ask that House File 2244 be referred to Health and Human Service Finance.
Okay. Do you have any amendments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. There will be an amendment to this bill going forward. Both the constituency group which asked for the bill and Health and Human Services have worked together. They will be limiting the scope of this bill to a pilot project, but those amendments can be dealt with in Health and Human Service Finance because it will be changing the cost of the program going forward.
Okay, sounds good. Why don't you speak to your bill?
Right. Thank you very much. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I will have an author's amendment that will focus my legislation to some extent. I would like to move this bill in the shape that it is for this morning's presentation. The original idea behind this bill was to extend the property-assessed clean energy financing mechanism to our long-term care facilities. Property-assessed clean energy, or PACE, is a method for financing lighting, HVAC, sensory systems, and other energy-related improvements in commercial buildings across the state of Minnesota. There are more than 200 PACE-financed projects in our state. This original bill was intended to specifically recognize the property assessment and repayment method for clean energy investments. But rather than jumping in with both feet for our long-term care system, we are going to be taking a more measured approach, trying a couple of projects over the course of the next year to ensure that our prospective payment system will operate in the manner which allows full recognition of savings, which are realized through these energy investment systems for our long-term care facilities. I have with me Peter Klein from the St. Paul Port Authority, who can describe the PACE program in a little more detail. Mr. Klein has also been involved with the discussions with the Department of Health and Human Services, which is giving rise to this future amendment calling for the pilot program for the energy savings for our long-term care facilities.
Thank you, Representative Cleburne. Just state your name for the record and please proceed.
Peter Klein, I am Vice President of Finance for the St. Paul Port Authority. Thank you for having me present today. St. Paul Port Authority offers several financing tools that are statewide for energy efficiency and renewable energy projects. We have funded over several hundred projects throughout the state, from solar to the efficiency projects that we're looking at, very similar to the senior care facilities. We have financed over $150 million of these projects throughout the state, and those projects currently are saving in excess of 500 billion BTUs annually. Nearly every one of these projects has produced positive cash flow to the property owner, so that the payments to us for the financing is something less than the actual energy savings and repairs and maintenance costs that they are providing. So it is a positive cash flow investment for the property owner to make these improvements. We believe that PACE, Property Assessed Clean Energy, does offer the senior care industry some advantages to finance these projects. We see a great need for these investments in senior care and would like to work with the department to test this out and truly show that it does provide cost-effective energy efficiency projects while saving the taxpayer dollars. And so we look forward to working with the department on the projects and really improving the care of the individuals that are residing in these facilities. So certainly open to any questions.
Thank you. Members, questions? Representative Keel?
Thank you. Can you repeat that savings again? It was $150 million.
We have funded $150 million, approximately $150 million of projects, around 300 projects throughout the state. And the savings in BTUs is in excess of 500 billion BTUs. So our stated goal was a trillion BTUs, so we're about halfway there. But the actual savings on $150 million is probably in that $20 million range annually.
Okay, any other questions? No, would anyone else like to testify to this bill? Looks like DHS is coming to the table.
Madam Chair, Dan Pollack, Assistant Commissioner for DHS. I just want to add that we appreciate the author's willingness to consider technical assistance and a delete all amendment at the next committee stop on this. We do have concerns with the bill as drafted because of the way that the other operating rate, which would pay for any special assessment, or I'm sorry, fixed external, which would pay for any special assessment, might end up going considerably up if we didn't have a limiting factor. And so we look forward to seeing that limiting factor in the next committee stop.
Representative Cleburne, would you like to address that or the testifier?
Well, we believe that the reimbursement for this special assessment would be treated as all other special assessments have been treated, and so it would be an external cost. However, we also believe that we will be saving utility costs as well as repairs and maintenance in excess of that. So the ultimate result would be a reduction to the taxpayer.
Mr. Klein, how is that saving shared with the state?
Maybe
Mr. Pollack can help answer that. Is this savings from energy efficiency shared with the state?
Madam Chair, I think as drafted it would not be, because as drafted you would basically continue to collect on a median rate of energy costs, and your individual facility rates might be lower, considerably lower. Mm-hmm. But if we can do a pilot project and actually measure some of the energy savings and have a shared savings mechanism in law, I think there's a way to do that, at least to test it out.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cleburne.
I do appreciate the fact that both members on opposite sides of this bill are sitting together at this table with me. As everyone on this committee knows, I'm a mediator by profession, and I love being able to hear both sides of a discussion. For me, I'm asking you to please refer this, as the committee, to please go ahead and refer this bill forward as we are continuing to work on it. We are looking for a place to find those efficiencies for our state, both in the amount of energy that we are conserving and the dollars that we are spending. And so I'm asking for your consideration, and please vote yes and move this bill forward. Thank you.
Okay. With that, I'm going to renew the motion to re-refer House File 2244 to Health and Human Services Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. Motion passed. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to give the gavel to Vice Chair Lippert.
All right, Chair Schultz, you'll stay in place.
Yeah, I'm going
to
stay here.
To present your bill? Okay.
I'm going to move House File 2548 to be referred to Health and Human Services Finance, and I'm going to have the agency come and testify. This is the nursing home VBR, value-based reimbursement bill. We're going to have take testimony, and then we have several amendments.
Mr. Pollack.
Okay, Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz, thank you so much for the opportunity to testify in favor of House File 2548. This is the bill language representing the governor's proposed budget changes to value-based reimbursement. I'm Dan Pollack, Assistant Commissioner for DHS, as I've already said. First, I want to start out responding to some of the criticisms about this proposal that I have heard in other committee testimony and some of the conversations that we've had with stakeholders about it. It's a value proposition, and nursing homes in all parts of our state are absolutely critical and are important parts of our delivery system, and we agree that they need adequate reimbursement to hire skilled direct care staff and achieve high-quality care outcomes for our most vulnerable citizens. None of that changes the fact that Medicaid spending in this area must still be held accountable for state and federal taxpayers, as well as private pay residents, who are now seeing costs of more than $95,000 per year in this setting. The state's share alone in this area of our budget has increased by about 76%, from $361 million in 2015 to upwards of $630 million by the end of the forecasted period. In January, you should have all received an independent, nonpartisan evaluation of the VBR system. And that evaluation found that there was no evidence that VBR's existing quality incentives had led to higher facility quality. About half the facilities increased their quality, and roughly the other half declined in quality. The evaluation predicted that under the current system, few facilities are likely to meet the spending limit in the future, and absent a change in policy, they would have no incentive for quality. So the evidence is really in the numbers. If you look at the way the quality limit is set today, almost all nursing homes, 97.5% of them, are operating and receiving their cost-based reimbursement below the quality-related spending limit. And that's the key reason why the governor's budget proposes changes that incorporate this independent evaluation's recommended modifications into our quality score methodology and changing the quality limit in order to ensure we are truly purchasing value, cost relative to quality adjusted for acuity. As you know, under the proposed quality limit reforms, a below-average facility would be limited to about 80% of metro median. A higher-quality facility would receive up to 120% of metro median. And even with these changes, value-based reimbursement will continue, meaning nursing homes can have their care-related direct care-related costs reimbursed up to the limits based on their quality score. Direct care staffing wages will continue to be reimbursable at market rates. Workers' health insurance benefits, importantly, would continue to be fully reimbursed as a pass-through cost. And so that system would continue. The other major component of the governor's proposal is a change to the allowable inflation rate of the other operating rate. And I know that's concerning to some folks. This component of the reimbursement covers the cost of dietary, housekeeping, laundry, maintenance, plant operations, and administrative costs. However, under the current law allowing for unlimited inflation in these components, the portion attributable to administrative costs has increased by 26%, about $7 per resident day, over the 2013 to 2017 period. And that's more than all the other components combined in terms of the increase. That's why the governor's budget establishes an objectively neutral benchmark for future inflationary increases of other operating. It's the Skilled Nursing Facility Market Basket Index, which is currently 3.05%. There are obviously other items in the governor's budget package on VBR. We're happy to discuss those in further detail. I want to just say I look forward to working with you this session to ensure we're able to build meaningful pay for performance into our nearly $1.5 billion of state and federal nursing home spending annually.
Thank you, Mr. Pollack. Author's amendments now?
I'm going to move the A1 amendment. This is a technical amendment from the agency, I believe. And Mr. Pollack, if you wanted to.
I think that's from House Research.
Oh, that's from House Research.
All right. I'm going to turn it over to Val Cook, our director, for amendment discussions. I think the A1 is you, right?
You want to speak to the A1?
Madam Chair and members, the A1 amendment is meant to be kind of a technical cleanup amendment that I worked on with staff at the Department of Human Services. And most of these changes are related to the language in the bill that relates to the property payment rates and also the new language related to interim and settle-up rates.
Okay. Any questions about the A1 amendment?
Any discussion on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. A1 amendment is adopted. Anyone opposed? Seeing none, A1 amendment is adopted. The A3 amendment.
I'll move the A3 amendment. Chair Lippert?
Is there a discussion on the Ms. Cook, would you choose to explain the A3 amendment?
Hi, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Cook. I'm with the Department of Human Services Nursing Facility Rates and Policy Division. And so I need to... Could I ask for clarification on which one is the A3 amendment?
This is the related party amendment.
The related party, okay. So this language is providing some additional language that would require disclosure of related party transactions. Under current law, we do have audit authority to ask for this information, and we are able to deal effectively with related party transactions under current law. So basically what this additional language is doing is just clarifying and requiring upfront disclosure of those related party transactions.
Thank you, Ms. Cook. Is there discussion on the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? A3 amendment is adopted. A4 amendment.
I'll move the A4 amendment, Chair Lippert, and this is the conversion settle up amendment if you want to discuss it.
Madam Chair, yes, members of the committee. So this language is new language to address change of ownership. And under current law, if there's a sale of a nursing facility to a new operator, that new operator would continue to receive the VBR payment rate for approximately 24 to 27 additional months, regardless of the spending that the new operator is doing under VBR. This language, the way it's designed, could go either way. So if a new operator chooses to invest additional resources in the operation of the nursing home, this interim and settle-up rate mechanism would recognize that. If a new operator was spending less than the previous owner, this methodology would also recognize that. So the idea here is to kind of sever the relationship between the payment rates of the old owner and the new owner.
Thank you, Ms. Cook. Are there questions about this amendment, discussion of the A4 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A4 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? A4 amendment is adopted. The A5 amendment.
I'll move the A5 amendment. This is changing the caps on the payments to nursing homes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Cook?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this language is was drafted, put together as a in response to a technical assistance request. And basically what it does is under current VBR, there is a component of the rate that's called the other operating price. That other operating price includes the cost for housekeeping, laundry, dietary, plant operations and maintenance, and administrative costs. And the rate setting mechanism for that is we take those costs and we total those for the seven county metro area, and we figure out what the median per day cost is of the seven county metro area. We multiply that by 105%, and that establishes the other operating price for all facilities in the state. What this amendment is doing is breaking that other operating price into some subcomponents. And the for laundry, dietary, and housekeeping, those costs would be, again, summed together for the seven-county metro area. A median cost would be determined and would be multiplied by 105%, and that would be the established price for all facilities in the state for those three cost categories. The second piece of this is that plant operations and maintenance and administrative costs would be capped at the price for those for that component of the rate would be capped at 1% annually for 4 years. After the 4 years is up, it would then revert to what is in the governor's proposal language, where those costs are that price, not cost. The price would be adjusted for the SNF market basket.
Thank you, Ms. Cook. Is there discussion on the A5 office amendment? Representative Munson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have a question for the testifier. When you're changing the costs from other operating expenses to specifically laundry, housekeeping, and dietary costs, what expenses are being excluded from this, and what was there any opposition from making this defining this specifically for these three items?
Ms. Cook.
Madam Chair, Representative, there aren't necessarily costs being excluded because this portion of the rate is established on a price-based model. What this language is doing is just breaking that component of the rate into two separate pieces, allowing for more growth in laundry, dietary, and housekeeping than is being allowed for admin and plant operation costs.
Representative Munson?
Okay, thank you.
Additional questions?
I'm going to add to that comment, Representative Munson. Thank you, Chair LaBird. So initially in the governor's proposal, there was a 3% cap on operating costs. And in the metro area, we're going to see an increase in the minimum wage that will go into effect in St. Paul and Minneapolis. And so to make sure that they were able to increase those wages and not come up to that cap, we removed that cap and then capped maintenance, plant operations, those pieces of the operating cost at administrative overhead at 1%. Instead of capping the others at everything at 3%, so to accommodate that increase in minimum wage.
Thank you, Chair Schultz. Any additional discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A5 author's amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? A5 amendment is adopted. The bill is in the shape the author desires, so back to testimony on House File 2548. So Joanne Snyder from SEIU Healthcare is on our list. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Joanne Snyder.
If you pull the microphone forward just a little bit. Great, thank you. Proceed.
Thank you, Chair Schultz and members of the committee. My name is Joanne Snyder. I live in Frilly. I work at the Estate of Frilly Nursing Home. I've worked there for 19 years. I serve as a dietary aide, and now I'm a cook. I'm a member of the SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. I want to thank legislators when you improved the rate of the 2015. You made a huge difference in our lives. As a veteran cook, I only make $14.75. And I want to say thank you for the recent raises. But not all workers have gained equally. And generally, dietary, especially housekeeping and laundry workers, have not gained equally. My friend, Lori, works in laundry. She has worked there a long time. On her wage scale, she is at $11.04 an hour. New hires in laundry and housekeeping start at $10 an hour. This is not the time to limit their wages. Because of the wages, we still struggle with staffing. Our dietary aides start at $11.50 an hour. When we hire someone, they find out that this is a hard job. We not only have to serve and prepare food, but we have to make sure our residents, different medical needs, get the right foods. We have to thicken their drinks so our elderly residents can swallow them. We have not done. When we are done serving, everything needs to be cleaned extra carefully and protect vulnerable people from diseases that spread easily. We also want to try to spend time with the residents who often have no one else. New workers realize they can make just as much for a difficult job. On weekends, we should have one cook, one aide. But for most of the last 2 years, it's been just me in the kitchen. That's because we can't keep any dietary aid. So I have cook, and serve for 40 to 45 people. After that, I clean up and do all the dishes by myself. This is incredible stress for me. I was diagnosed with a bleeding ulcer. Another time, a manager from the facility drove me to the nearest hospital because my heart rate was racing so fast. Our staffing problems will only get worse when the Minneapolis and St. Paul raise their minimum wages. With a few years, almost anyone will be able to go to those sites and get jobs that start at 15 hours. Those homes, they will need to raise their wages to comply with the law. Homes like mine will have to raise our wages to compete. Our CNAs are close to $15, but other workers have further to go. Putting the ceiling on rates for housekeeping, dietary, laundry workers is the reverse of what is needed to do. I love my job. Even though it means a lot of extra work, I'm really proud that we are able to offer residents different choices for our bistro menu. We have to work extra to take care of those orders ahead of time, prepare separate meals. But I know that a little of those choices means so much for the people in the nursing homes. I just wish my job paid enough that I didn't have to worry so much about my own health and my own meals. There have been times that I have gone to the food bank just so I have something to eat. Just a few extra dollars a week make so much difference to me. I know my friend Lori and other co-workers in housekeeping and laundry struggle even more. Thank you for the amendment that does not cap our rates. As you go forward, please try to find a protected all workers from the cuts.
Thank you, Ms. Snyder.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
You're welcome.
And I'll call forward our next testifier, Bernie Hess. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm Bernie Hess, UFCW 1189. We represent workers in 51 facilities, all the way from Grand Rapids all the way down to Winona. It's hard to top the testimony of the last person. We want to work with Representative Schultz on this bill. What you need to understand is we really got to maximize what's available. So we want to work with the operators so they can figure out how to maximize what they get from the state. But we also have a real problem. The payment system that was put in place a few years ago resulted in some great raises and improvements for direct care, not so much for support staff, and we represent all sorts of folks everywhere from RNs. We have folks in maintenance, we have people in laundries, dietary, we have LPN, CNA. So a lot of people are affected by this. And what we want to do is we will work, you know, it's March, let's see where we are in May. We also want to prevent outsourcing because we're running into a real problem with a number of the operations where some of the services have been outsourced, and that has led to some problems. The care system is a very fragile system, as you all know, and the public perception sometimes of workers isn't the greatest, and we really want to work with all stakeholders to lift folks up on that and professionalize it. And this is a real craft and an art, and people do this out of their heart when they work. Another thing that, you know, the immigrant workforce, I was just out at my mom's facility yesterday, and a number of those people are going to be gone, and how we fill out on that. So anything we can do to maximize the resources going into the homes, we want to work with you on. We understand how it is putting a budget together. This is messy stuff, but we need training, we need folks that know how to supervise, and we also need to really lift this profession up for all folks, whether direct care, or they do support services. So thank you, and we look forward to helping you craft this.
Thank you, Mr. Hess. Our next testifier is Toby Pearson. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson with Care Providers in Minnesota, today also with the Long-Term Care Imperative. As you know, the new payment system was implemented for nursing facilities on January 1 of 2016. The new system replaced a system that was chronically underfunded for many, many years. Under the proposal, nursing homes will lose more than $200 million in funding. $68 million cut from the state budget, a matching dollar from federal money, and because of rate equalization, a matching private pay dollar. This cut is in this biennium alone, and we're not sure what the next biennium's cuts will look like. These cuts will have the greatest impact on wages, benefits, and training, which comprise about 65% of the nursing home costs. These proposed changes are in spite of the fact that the Department of Human Services' own report states that changes to value-based reimbursement system are premature because trends in spending, access, and workforce are still developing. We agree. With just over 2 years since its start date, we believe it is premature to make significant changes to VBR until enough data and experience is collected. Nursing facilities have made significant investments in their employees, and these changes will mean fewer resources for providing care. Value-based reimbursement has been a huge success. CNA wages going up more than 26%. LPN and RN wages going up about 20%. Full-time employees covered by employee-sponsored health insurance in nursing homes increasing 10%. Despite this, we still continue to struggle with workforce issues, with the net loss of CNAs resulting from the challenging labor market. These proposed changes to VBR will serve to further hamper the ability to recruit and retain skilled caregivers and undermine access to the care and services seniors need. The proposed cuts come in three ways. First, the changes to care-related limits and quality score. While we applaud the direction of increasing the incentives to quality, in our opinion, the blunt instrument approach taken by the governor's proposal, or this proposal now that it's been adopted, is not acceptable. The use of quality measures to establish cost limits is an integral part of VBR. However, assessing outcomes and proposing changes based on 12 months of data is still premature. Second, with only 2 years of activity, it's difficult to assume any trend. We expect growth in the other operating to mitigate over time. Capping increased changes to other operating rates will adversely affect key nursing home employees. While we appreciate removing and changing the dietary housekeeping and laundry, you're still leaving behind important employees in the form of maintenance and plant operations. These are the folks that keep the place running. Because of the connection between the caps of elderly waiver rates and nursing home reimbursement, there will also be a cut to the caps of elderly waiver rates. Finally, property. While many Minnesota's nursing homes need to be replaced or extensively remodeled to meet the demands of 60,000 Minnesotans turning 65 every year, the governor's proposed property payment system will not address this goal. Instead of investing in it, it will actually cut rates for more than half the nursing facilities over the six-year phase-in. While we appreciate the attempt to address this long-standing issue, this proposal is not the solution. A lot of good work has gone into the property system and this report, but it may make sense to scale back the breadth of this proposal and pilot a system with moratorium exception projects and continue to make sure that our property gets redeveloped. Value-based reimbursement was adopted in 2015, and it costs the state less today than was originally budgeted. We simply cannot understand why, in the midst of a $1 billion surplus, we would want to cut long-term care rates.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carrie Thurlow with Leading Age Minnesota, also here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. I'll start first by echoing that value-based reimbursement, or VBR, was passed in 2015 with strong bipartisan support from both chambers. At the time, nursing facility reimbursement rates were at least $25 per resident per day below the cost of care. So those first few years of implementation were really just designed to catch up with the actual cost of care. And the DHS evaluation, as has already been referenced a few times today, was really based on 1 year's worth of data and 2 years worth of implementation. And as Mr. Pearson stated, but I think it's worth repeating again, that own evaluation stated that it would be premature at this time to make changes to value-based reimbursement as things are still being worked out. The second point I would make, and as a reminder, nursing homes are subject to rate equalization, which means that private pay rates cannot exceed the Medicaid rates set by the state. This is a unique state policy that only one other state has. But that policy means that for every state dollar we save under this proposed proposal actually has a triple impact on nursing homes, because they will also lose federal funds as well as have private pay rates decrease. So that means that any savings of the state you can triple, which means, as Mr. Pearson indicated, that's about a $200 million impact to nursing homes going forward. I also want to underscore and talk a little bit about the three components you've heard a lot about today, but I'm going to try to just break it down as well. There's basically three components to the rates: direct care costs, which cover the costs directly related to the care of the resident, for example, nursing and CNAs; other operating, which was the subject of one of the amendments that we discussed today, that relates to costs not directly related to care. Now you've broken that into two different components, the dietary, housekeeping, and laundry. And then under the amendment, you now have kind of a second component to other operating, which are maintenance as well as plant operations. I'll get back to that in a moment. And then property, which relates to kind of the building, the physical plant itself. Of these three components, two were part of the reform in 2015, which is what we call VBR. Property was not reformed in 2015. I want to just say that to be reimbursed under VBR, nursing homes have to first incur costs up front. It's a key component to the system. And then there is a 27-month waiting period as cost reports are filed that then they are either reimbursed directly under direct care costs or subject to a price-based system. That means under this proposal, under the direct care costs, there will be nursing homes that have already incurred costs, submitted their cost reports, and will receive an actual cut, meaning that they've spent money, invested primarily in wages and benefits, and will not get reimbursed fully for those costs. Going forward, as it's fully phased in, more and more will have that impact. It's important to note also that those direct care costs are subject to a cost-based system, subject to a limit. There are no built-in margins here for facilities to gain extra profit. If they are over the limit, that means they are incurring costs that will not be reimbursed. So there's a natural inclination for facilities to stay well below those margins or those limits that were already talked about and are subject to this. The other operating piece, whether you're talking about under the current law or under the amendment, is a price-based system subject to cap for growth. In other words, the price is the price for all of those costs kind of in that bucket. And if providers overspend, it means that they're not getting reimbursed. There's sort of a natural limit to it. That's how the system was reimbursed, or was designed, excuse me. In general, the impact of the changes proposed in this bill and the governor's budget will mean that facilities will not have the resources to continue raising wages and benefits for all who work in nursing homes. We know that this proposal in its first few years, the VBR system, has resulted in wage and benefit increases for workers, and we know that they still are not getting paid enough. This is honorable work, and we need to make sure that there are resources available so that we have the workforce needed to care for this growing senior population and the demands that we know that will impact this system going forward. I'm cognizant of time, so I will just say that Mr. Pearson also mentioned the property proposal that is in this particular bill. It was not reformed in 2015, and while we do strongly believe that this needs to be reformed, this proposal simply has too many unintended consequences and will disrupt debt obligations that are oftentimes 30-year debt obligations. So we have concerns about that as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thurlow. I have a Bob Dahl on the list. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee, for letting me testify before you today. My name is Bob Dahl. I'm the president of CASIA. CASIA is a new organization that's a result of the merger between Augustana Care and Elam Care, two nonprofit, faith-based senior care organizations that have combined been serving older adults in this state for over 200 years. Among the services we provide are skilled nursing services. Among the services we provide are skilled nursing services at 13 locations around the state. For a couple of decades, the state of Minnesota has had a goal of reducing the number of skilled nursing beds. To achieve that goal, the Department of Human Services has provided incentives to providers like us to permanently give up licensed beds in exchange for a rate increase on the remaining beds. The governor's current budget budget proposal includes a provision to eliminate all of those incentive programs. One of the incentive programs is called consolidation, and it works like this. A provider like us agrees to permanently close an entire facility. DHS calculates the savings to the state and shares a portion of that savings back to the provider. It's called a closure rate. That closure rate must be used to make physical improvements in another skilled nursing facility. In 2017, our organization closed our facility in Watertown. DHS calculated the savings from that closure and calculated the portion of the savings that would be provided back to us. And our plan is to use that closure rate to help us replace a 50-year-old outdated nursing home in Maple Plain. The plan has been approved by DHS and the Department of Health. If the provision in the governor's budget is approved and it's embedded in the property proposal, it will take away that closure rate after 1 year, even though the closure and the savings are permanent. And we will not be able to replace that old and outdated building. Frankly, from our perspective, it feels like an old-fashioned bait and switch. We acted in good faith in our decision and in our planning, and our request is that you prevent this change from taking place. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have them. Thank you.
Okay. Questions for the testifier? Thank you. Are there additional testifiers, others who wish to testify on this bill? Chair Schultz. Oh, Representative Cleaver.
Thank you, Chair Lippert. My question actually goes to Ms. Thurlow, if you don't mind, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm new to the committee. So please accept my question in the light of learning. Okay. And I want to thank all of the testifiers for the comments that they've made. It's a very complicated system, as you well know, and I'm just trying to get my head around it. So coming from the business world myself, I'm thinking, as I'm listening to all of these statements about buildings and even the last comment of bait and switch and planning and certainty, I'm wondering, as we're looking at our employees and being able to keep those employees, I'm just trying to get my head around the fact, what is it that we really need to think about in the realm of salaries to be able to maintain dietary staff, housekeeping staff, nursing staff? Do you, and if you don't have it with you today, I would love to know your thoughts about what those salaries should really look like. Because as we hear one testifier say, I can't imagine living in Minneapolis on $10 an hour. It would be impossible to pay rent anywhere. So what do those salaries actually look like? And what would the proposal in your mind be to get those dollars into the facility for those reimbursement rates.
Yes.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative, and I may, I have a couple colleagues here who also may be able to answer it. That's a really big question.
It's a huge question. That's why I said you can send me an email later. It's okay.
You know, so my initial thoughts are, you know, because we have such a tightly constrained way that we finance nursing homes, insofar as this legislative body sets the Medicaid reimbursement rate, which is by far the largest piece of nursing home financing, and then by virtue of that also sets the private pay rate. You know, operating funding is extremely constrained. And I think that the DHS report has shown that the VBR system that we passed in 2015 has had a very positive impact of increasing wages and benefits for employees throughout. I believe that that report, if I'm recalling off the top of my head, and please forgive me because it's memory, I think that according to that report, CNA wages right now are at around $16.40 an hour. You know, which I would say, in my own personal opinion, still needs to go up. But having said that, it increases over time under the VBR system. And I think that that's one of the key points to take away, is that the VBR system is designed to allow those wage increases over time as facilities can invest in wages and benefits. And that our concern is that the net impact to the proposal of this bill that is part of the governor's budget is that it will have a chilling impact on investing in wages and benefits. As providers get concerned that there will be changes made over time, even if they're under the limit today, that's a very concerning thing, that they may incur costs that may not be reimbursed.
I have a follow-up. So we keep going back to the nursing wages, which have gone up. The piece that is concerning to me is the housekeeping, dietary, and kitchen staff. Having been the daughter of a dietitian, I understand the work that they do and the fact that these wages are incredibly low. People see nursing staff. People don't see kitchen staff when they come to visit their family members. And they don't see housekeeping staff when they come to visit. So I just want to make it clear for the record that we have to have some mechanism in place to raise those wages. And so I would love to have that further discussion with you at some other time, if you wouldn't mind. But thank you. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Little. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Schultz, given the chance that nursing homes are facing the workforce shortages and low occupancy, won't this make it worse?
Chair Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Lippert, Representative. During the VBR implementation, administrative expenses increased 26%, plant maintenance 25%, while dietary and laundry only increased 12% and 11%. So I don't think it was directed to where there was need in terms of increasing wages. And I think we need to do a better job of directing where we have those shortages and where those needs are. So this bill is not actually going to cut the wages or cut reimbursement. It's going to reduce the growth, the percentage growth in those reimbursement rates. So I think, go ahead.
Yeah. Representative Keel.
I will beg to differ with you about the rates. I think that there are differences where all over the state. So I know that some of my nursing homes really spent time raising the rates for support staff. And I would even venture, and maybe some of the testifiers can agree or disagree with me on this, but I believe that sometimes maintenance, laundry, those types of people, support staff, end up doing more than one position because that's the only way for that nursing home to provide the services. They just plain can't hire people. And my concern is, with these operating cuts that, you know, this change, first of all, I believe we need to give this more time. to really work. My rural nursing homes are pleased with how this is working. Staff quite often stop me, and we're not talking about just nurses or RNs. In fact, I know that my RNs rarely see the wage increase that the support staff did, because these nursing homes are often run by an RN who is working weekends just to fill in because of the staff that they can't fill. I mean, they literally cannot fill, and there just isn't bodies there to do these things. So I'm very concerned about the conversation for my rural nursing homes, and I believe that the VBR system needs to be working longer or extended longer. I'm concerned about the property rate proposal. I don't know. I just really think, when I think about some of my nursing homes that are trying to do some facility maintenance, this is going to be detrimental to them entirely. And certainly we need to be careful about the cost, the loss of money, the funds that we have between the federal and the state averages, so that we make sure that we are not shooting ourselves in the foot and not being able to fund these nursing homes. And I will say this publicly, I am very concerned that this will close my nursing homes. And I have seen it happen many times. Nobody has suggested it to me, but I have watched it happen, and I know I've got some barely hanging on. And they are trying desperately, and this VBR has worked well for them. And I really have dedicated staff, whether they're providing food or maintenance. In the rural areas, I've seen a lot of challenges just trying to find enough people. So I probably am redundant in my comments, but I'm very concerned that this will not help the nursing homes. In fact, it will probably, they'll probably lose quite a few. Thank you.
Chair Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Lippert. So just to respond to that, I think we all want to make sure that we're reimbursing nursing homes that can address the workforce shortages. And, you know, given that in greater Minnesota they're seeing reimbursement rates that are a function of cost in the metro area, that should help alleviate some of those costs. But I think that we're going to need new revenue sources if we want to fund long-term care in the future, and that includes reimbursing nursing homes adequately. So I would encourage you to think about not sunsetting the provider tax, or putting the provider tax on other facilities to raise revenue, so we can fund long-term care in nursing homes and pay competitive wages so they're not closing.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I get a question for Commissioner Pollack. Commissioner, you heard the testimony of from the concerns of testifiers, also from Representative Keel. What was the rationale by the governor when we got a $1 billion surplus to make a reduction on the nursing homes and also the property tax or the property issue? Can you fill us in on their thinking of why they took those types of steps?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, thank you for the question. I think I articulated some of this on the quality limits in my opening statement, which was that we did have this independent evaluation report. They did make recommendations about some changes now that we are about 4 years since VBR was authorized by the legislature, and this is a good time to really consider whether the cost trend lines are going in the right direction and whether we're getting the right value for what we're buying. If we wait another 2 years, the price tag will continue to go up. And so we're trying to do this in a thoughtful way that recognizes the value and also recognizes the potential for needing to pay higher wages continuing, like you heard, in terms of higher minimum wages or higher direct care salaries. On the property rate, I didn't address that in my statement, so let me actually take that on as well. What the governor's proposal does on the property rate is actually taking all of these kind of one-offs that you heard testimony about and really trying to phase those out over time. So it's not an immediate light switch. It's a six-year phase out of those and replacement with a fair rental rate appraisal system where all properties in the state would have the opportunity, all nursing homes in the state would have the opportunity to make facility improvements, receive a fair rental rate appraisal of the improvements that they made, and then receive a payment, property payment rate that reflects those improvements. So what we're trying to do is get away from, you know, kind of these onesie-twosies. We have talked about this with the industry. I recognize that there is a devil in the details kind of concern with the way that we're approaching this. I would say we're, you know, open to continued conversations with, you know, the legislature about how to address the property rate issue. That is actually new spending. So obviously, you know, there are different ways you can do new spending on property in terms of what we're buying. So open to conversation.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so usually when you make a reduction in one area of $200 million approximately, was it shifted to someplace else in the budget that you're aware of?
Commissioner Pollack.
Madam Chair, Representative Gruenhagen, I disagree with the characterization that it's a cut or a shift. There's a change in the spending on this line item in reflecting of the way that we're trying to come up with some objectively neutral ways to pay based on what we think the costs are going forward.
Okay. Representative?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer my A2 amendment at this time.
Okay. The A2 amendment will be passed out. We'll wait for this amendment to be passed out.
Oh, while that's being passed out, Mr. Chair, could I have
Representative?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Kerry Thurlow come forward to respond to the Commissioner's comments? She's here? Sure. Or whoever she wants to bring along.
Please say your name for the record.
Hello, my name is Todd Bergstrom. I work with Care Providers in Minnesota and are here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative.
And Jeff Bostick with Leading Age Minnesota, also on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative.
Representative, Madam Chair, as it relates to the property proposal, I think the way I would characterize it is it, in general, does not provide a lot of funding. On a budget line, it essentially has a little bit of funding added in, but over time will save the state money. Our underlying issue with it is that if it's meant to be a fair rental value system, the rental rate, which has been selected, 5.5%, and this is getting really into the weeds of the proposal, but it is a very complicated proposal. We believe that that is far too low. Will not incent or provide the financing necessary for nursing facilities to replace, renovate, rebuild, et cetera.
Thank you.
Okay.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Well, I'm ready to offer the A2 then.
Okay,
and basically what the A2 would do, it would not address the property issue, but it would eliminate the reduction of the quality-related cap that would prevent cuts to nursing homes. I'd like to offer that amendment.
Okay. Chair Schultz. Invite DHS to come forward to respond to the amendment. Please state your name.
Mr. Chair, Dan Pollack.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, as I understand, the A2 amendment is removing the governor's proposal on the quality-related cap, and I think we would oppose doing that. I think I can speak for the commissioner definitively in saying that addressing the quality-related limit is the most important part of this proposal, and the absence of any change to that really does do a disservice to both the public and private payers.
Thank you, Mr. Pollack.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I would just say, you know, the reason to vote in favor of this at this time, I think this is going to go to HHS Finance, and there'll be more discussion on this. And I think that we should put it into the mix of the discussion. I know it'll be there anyway, but I think put it into that discussion without this cap on it rather than with the cap, and then you know, vet the ultimate HHS finance bill with this, without this cap in there. The other thing, I'll be interested to see what the Senate actually proposes on this issue here. And again, it is a somewhat concerning that we seem to be making a reduction on nursing homes at a time where we have $1 billion surplus. And, Mr. Chair, I would ask for a roll call.
Chair Schultz.
Okay, thank you, Chair Lippert and Representative Gruenhagen. I'm going to urge a no vote on this amendment, and I think if we want to talk about when we get the fiscal notes in HHS finance, right, feel free to offer this amendment again, and then we'll, you can request a fiscal note on your amendment to see what the difference would be. I would encourage you to do that. And then also encourage you to think of some revenue sources to help pay for this if we want to remove this cap and continue with the VBR payment reform. And one other comment, I think that going forward, we really need to look at what was driving what are driving the costs in nursing homes, and really try to do our best to control that cost growth, but at the same time improving quality. And I think that was the intent of VBR, and as we've heard from DHS, we really didn't do that with the quality indicator we're using, and so we really need to visit different quality indicators that are attainable to nursing homes so they get reimbursement based on improving quality. But I would also, I would just encourage you to think of new revenue sources. This is not moving in the Senate, so I don't know if they're going to listen to the governor's nursing home proposal, but maybe DHS can respond to that if they know if this is going to be heard in the Senate as informational only at all or in other ways.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, I don't believe that the Senate is hearing your bill specifically. We obviously have presented the governor's budget there and continue to have discussions in the Senate about the various components of the human services budget.
Thank you, Mr. Pollack.
I'm just going to say one more thing, Chair Lippert and Representative Gruenhagen. I keep hearing that we have $1 billion surplus, so we don't have $1 billion surplus. If we account for inflation and on our spending and putting money in reserves, and the last revenue projections were low, we may have about $250 million surplus.
Thank you, Chair Schultz. We have one additional question. Representative Cleaborn.
Well, this is to Representative Schultz. I just wanted to say thank you for bringing us forward. As we had so many, I think the number that was used today, 60,000 individuals in the state of Minnesota turning 65 every year going forward, it's a lot of care that we're going to need to have to figure out how we provide for, and looking for mechanisms that work, that provide quality care for our family members and for all Minnesotans, I think is a very important goal. And so I want to thank you for the work that you're doing to try to bring that to the fore and to make sure that all of our seniors across the state are cared for in a responsible and meaningful way. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Is there additional discussion on the U2 amendment? Representative?
Yeah, I do have a few ideas. Or thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a few ideas on revenue areas. But that being said, let's have the vote. Okay.
A roll call has been requested, so the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Schultz?
No.
Vice Chair Lippert?
No.
Representative Gruenhagen?
Yes.
Representative Keel?
Yes.
Representative Cleaborn?
No.
Representative Mason?
No.
Representative Munson?
Yes.
Representative Olson?
No.
There being three ayes and five nays, the motion does not prevail. Further discussion on the bill? Seeing none, Chair Schultz renews her motion to refer House File 2548 to HHS Finance as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. House File 2548 has been referred to Health and Human Services Finance as amended. The committee will recess and will reconvene in room 200 at 1245.
It's too warm.
I'll call the Division of the Long-Term Care Committee back to order. And as we begin, I need to entertain a motion to approve the minutes. Would someone move the minutes? Representative Cleavorn moves the minutes from March 18th. All those in favor, say aye. Aye.
We have a quorum, do we?
Aye.
We already had a quorum.
Oh, we did?
Oh, we had
a quorum. Sorry.
So I believe that since we had a quorum this morning, we can reconvene and move the minutes. And we do have a quorum now, so. So, to repeat, Representative Cleavorn moves the minutes.
I move the minutes for approval.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Minutes. Opposed? Minutes are adopted. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative.
See, it's come to my attention that HF 90 and HF 2548 have not been moved to this committee. They've actually been moved to HHS Finance. And... Pardon? Oh, and as a result, I don't think, can we deal with them when they're not been moved to this committee? That's the question. I had constituents. I was going to stop and talk to you earlier.
Which two did you say? 90. Thank you.
We need to recess. So I'm going to call recess so the staff can look into this.
Okay.
So the committee is in recess.
So you'll text or email us? Yep.
I imagine I'm
open. Let's take a 5-minute recess.
Oh, 5 minutes. Okay.
We have to redo all the amendments, including your vote that failed.
You can have an informational meeting. Take testimony. You just can't act on it.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, we could start by taking testimony on the bill, and then whenever it's sent down to us, it could happen in a few minutes. Just has to, the CA Finance has to write an email saying it's in the city of all.
I was with some constituents, and it's just a book from my district.
Thank you.
Patrick, it's Jen. Apparently, House File 9 hasn't been moved to move on to here, but it's just been here. And we're trying to hear the bell now, so we need to have it now. House File 9. And
especially at this time of year.
Yeah, no. Well, Megan's doing it. She has 3 years.
And we're not all in high. Hi, Megan.
My LA trip. No, her girls were the hot.
Papers to play.
No, if they got, I mean, there's a lot of bells and whistles. If they have direct appropriation, if it says, you know, $5 million, typically, they have found some road, so at the end of the day,
Well, I could have stayed and talked to that person.
Points is well taken.
Okay.
Oh, thank you.
Oops.
I got it.
So we'll need to do all the motions again on the DDR bill.
We'll
just need to go back for
a minute. She sent this out.
Yeah. This is now the episode.
We got it.
Oh, they had a whole bunch of us about 25 billion.
Oh, maybe I
can see one. Then we can take out. We have to do those.
Yeah, if they
feel better about them, they just say,
I call the division back to order. We now have the memo in front of us. So we'll have to take up House File 2548 again. So Chair Schultz, would you make the motion?
Sure. I move House File 2548 as amended to be re-referred to Health and Human Services Finance.
Okay, so the bill has been moved. It's not amended yet. We'll have to put the amendments back on.
Okay.
So, Chair Schultz, you move the A1 amendment?
I'll move the A1 amendment to House File 2548.
Okay, Chair Schultz moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? The A1 amendment is adopted.
I'll move the A3 amendment to House File 2548.
The A3 amendment has been moved. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Aye.
The A3 amendment is adopted. Chair Schultz, the A4 amendment.
I'll move the A4 amendment to House File 2548.
A4 amendment has been moved. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Aye.
The A4 amendment has been adopted. And the A5 amendment.
I'll move the A5 amendment to House File 2548.
The A5 amendment has been moved. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Aye.
Aye.
A5 amendment is adopted.
And the A2.
Representative Gruenhagen moves the A2 amendment.
And a roll call.
And a roll call. Any discussion on the A2 amendment? Seeing none, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Schultz?
No.
Vice Chair Lippert?
No.
Representative Gruenhagen?
Yes.
Representative Keel?
Yes.
Representative Cleavorn?
No.
Representative Mason?
No.
And Munson and Olson are absent. Representative Munson? Representative Olson.
There being two ayes and four nays, the motion is defeated. Other discussion on House File 2548 as amended? Chair Schultz renews her motion to refer House File 2548 as amended to Health and Human Services Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
No.
Aye.
The motion prevails. House File 2548 is referred as amended to Health and Human Services Finance. Now we have House File 90 in front of us. Chair Schultz, will you move?
I move House File 90 to be referred to Health and Human Services Finance.
So we have it before us. Chair Schultz, will you provide an overview of the bill?
Sure. Do we want to do the amendment? No.
Oh, we can do the amendment now. Will you move?
I move the A13 amendment to House File 90.
Chair Schultz moves the A13 amendment. Will you explain the amendment?
Sure. The amendment is the language for the tiered licensure of assisted living facilities. This language has been worked on extensively by many stakeholders and MDH. So I want to just thank AARP, Legal Aid, Elder Voices, the Long-Term Care Imperative, the Alzheimer's Association, Leading Age of Minnesota, Care Providers, MDH and DHS for getting together multiple days to work on this language on licensure. And we'll go into more detail after it's amended to the bill.
Any discussion on the A13 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? A13 amendment has been added to the bill. Continue, Chair.
Okay, so the House File 90 is the Elder Care Prevention Bill, an elder abuse prevention bill. It's a response to the multitude of stories from families we have heard last year and this year about widespread and often horrific and unthinkable abuse of older and vulnerable adults living in assisted living establishments and nursing homes. So this bill was moving through the legislature last session and did not get voted on the House floor. It was also moving through the Senate, also did not get out of the Senate. So this year, the stakeholders have come together to work on it even more, and the bill essentially sets up a tiered licensure for assisted living. Minnesota is the only state that doesn't license assisted living facilities. And with the multitude of abuse reports, we needed to make sure that the legislature and the agency had oversight to protect all our most vulnerable adults. And so this bill, in addition to licensure, eliminates fragmented care. Right now, care facilities work with outside companies to bring in different types of services, especially skilled care, but there is not a requirement that one person at a facility is overseeing a resident's individual care plan. This leads to mistakes because residents have to work with multiple different care providers to get the services they need. It also has language in it for home care rights, consumer protections, and enforcement. To better protect and serve the adults that depend on care facilities, this bill standardizes and provides clear guidelines to prevent retaliation and how vulnerable adults can pursue action. It also clearly outlines what is required in living contracts or living arrangements for different facilities and the type of notice that must be provided if a facility wishes to change the living arrangement. It also includes e-monitoring. Right now, nursing homes and assisted living facilities may ban the use of electronic devices for monitoring someone's room for any reason. For families who fear abuse, this is incredibly concerning. This bill lays out that residents do have the right to place an electronic monitoring device in their room or personal living area if they give notice. This bill also bans deceptive marketing. Many facilities use deceptive marketing to try and fill facility vacancies without fully understanding the type of care a resident needs or without explaining the limited care available at their facility. This bill has traveled through multiple committees, Health and Human Services Policy, Judiciary, Government Operations, and Commerce, and now it is before us, and I would welcome testimony.
Thank you, Chair Schultz. Commissioner Malcolm is the first testifier on our list. Please state your name for the record. Welcome to the committee and proceed.
Good
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Jan Malcolm, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health. We so appreciate this committee's time and the time and care of the members of the committee and the author, Chair Schultz, for the amount of not only time but really oversight and farsight that you are applying to this important issue. As Representative Schultz just indicated, this is a really important advancement in Minnesota's protections for elders and vulnerable adults, and it is a product of literally several years' worth of work and work that is continuing to this day. As Chair Schultz mentioned, there have been, and you've heard me mention in prior testimony, work groups that have been meeting since early last fall who've been just incredibly generous with their expertise and their time. The attitude and the openness with which all stakeholders have come together to try to learn more about each other's perspective has been invaluable, and that consultative process continues today. We're really pleased by the progress that's already been made and know that there is more work to do as we continue to dig into the details underneath what has been a really genuine coming together and agreement reached sort of at the level of broad principles. We have all agreed across the stakeholder groups that we do need to modernize our regulatory structure, that assisted living facilities should be regulated under a single unifying license structure. That was a very significant development when we reached that kind of agreement at a broad principle level. What's been happening in the last, particularly since early January and then accelerating into even more detail after the governor's budget proposal was released, is getting into the really specific detail about how the licensure structure and other important improvements, such as Chair Schultz just outlined, the establishment of additional rights for consumers and additional clarity about the enforcement of those rights. Those conversations literally are continuing weekly, if not daily, and we plan to continue in the spirit we've been working these last few months. I appreciate particularly Chair Schultz's patience and the committee's patience with the fact that there are many versions of language floating around as the stakeholders are taking great care, as they should, in making sure that the language reflects the agreements that we have been working under. So this is a work in progress, but today's version is a major step forward, and I thank the chair for offering the amendment today. The language in this bill and the aspirations of this bill are very robust. It's a long bill. It's a complicated bill, and I think it reflects the seriousness with which we all take these issues and all that we have learned in the last few years. I'm going to focus my comments on the A13 amendment, specifically the articles having to do with licensure and dementia care requirements. So Article 4, the assisted living licensure requirements, as the chair indicated, the basic idea here is that there are three levels of licensure that reflect criteria that's really already established in current home care statutes. So in very few instances are we developing a brand new concept that's never existed in Minnesota law. It's more about pulling together the elements of law that should apply to assisted living facilities that have previously been unclear or not applicable in assisted living. So the three levels of licensure that you see in the language before you today, the first is called a basic care facility. These are facilities that provide housing, supportive services, and additional services that are non-medical in nature, such as assistance with dressing, grooming, and toileting, providing reminders to take medication, and providing daily wellness checks. While as currently drafted, this is a licensure level, we want to be careful and clear to distinguish basic care facilities from assisted living facilities. So we do not call basic care facilities in this version of the language. They are not assisted living facilities. They are basic care facilities, a distinct level of service. Assisted living facilities, then, are those that provide both basic care as defined under the home care statutes and more comprehensive services that do include medical care, such as the services of a nurse and medication management, other complex and specialty health care services, and things like hands-on assistance with transfers and mobility. So it really is where consumers and residents go from needing just sort of basic monitoring to hands-on assistance with these tasks. The third level of licensure is assisted living with dementia care, facilities that provide all the assisted living facilities just described, but also offer and advertise that they offer specialized dementia care services. These facilities in this language may or may not have a secured dementia unit. If they have a locked unit, those require specific additional fire safety, building code, and staff requirements. Again, I want to emphasize that we're still actively working with stakeholders to develop some of these concepts, including the notion of the basic care facility. There are different points of view on whether that level of service does or does not require a licensure level. As drafted here, we're suggesting that basic care services would have a license, but I want you to be aware that that is still an active conversation about whether that level of regulation is necessary or not for this level of service. The fee structure for all three of the levels I described, or two levels, if that's where we end up from a licensure perspective, the fee structure for all levels will vary based on the licensing level and the bed size. So it will be a graduated fee system. The new licensing structure will be put into effect on August 1st, 2021. It does require a transition period to appropriately prepare for and be able to regulate under a change of this magnitude. The transition period would be as follows. From July 1st of this year, 2019, to June 30th of 2020, the Health Department would undertake expedited rulemaking, which takes a full year. We believe strongly that even though we are being quite ambitious in the statute and trying to be as detailed as possible, there will still be many important issues dealt with in the rulemaking, and we think it's vital that the public continue to have transparency and input into that rulemaking process. From July 1st of 2020, after we know the details of the system, to July 31st of 2021, we're recommending a full year for implementation planning and development for both the agency, for both MDH, and the care facilities. This is a very significant change, not only in regulation, but in operational requirements for assisted living facilities. And we think it's prudent to give both the department and facilities time to learn about and change their operations to be able to operate under the new licensure requirements in mid-2021. So now I'll just talk for a few minutes about some of the important substantive changes in this language from current law and regulations. Specific criteria and regulations are put in place regarding changes of ownership and management agreements. The ultimate goal of these regulations is to ensure, as Chair Schultz said, that a single accountable entity is responsible for all of the services provided under the license. Even if there are contracting relationships going on and different entities providing different components of the service, the goal and the requirement that there be one accountable license holder is something that that came strongly through the work group process for matters of clarity, of knowing who's accountable, who providers know must be accountable, and who consumers know is the accountable entity. Specific criteria are also set for the contracts between facilities and residents, whether that is the residency contract or the service contract. If those are two different contracts, they may be one, they may be two. But specific criteria are set for these contracts between the facilities and the residents. This process is designed to ensure that when entering into this contract, residents are fully informed as to their rights, and both parties know what to expect from their agreement. Minimum standards for all facilities are established and include items such as ensuring that residents have a way to request assistance for health and safety needs 24/7, ensuring that there is always a staff person on site who is able to respond to those requests, which includes that being awake staff, allowing residents to control who visits them and when, staff orientation and training requirements, including information on infection control and dementia care. From a facility standpoint, working utilities, adequate fire control methods like smoke detectors and fire extinguishers, and routine fire drills. New construction will be asked to present their plans to MDH for review and approval, which is a process we already have in place and conduct for nursing homes. Facilities will be required to provide potential residents with a written checklist of all services permitted under a facility's license, and the checklist must identify which of those services the facility is currently offering to provide and those which it is not. This is designed to prevent confusion and situations in which a resident signs a contract expecting a certain level of service only to find that the facility does not actually offer what was expected. MDH, the agency, will develop this uniform checklist for facilities to use. Current comprehensive home criteria are adopted for medication management in assisted living facilities. A requirement for medication reconciliation is added to ensure that medications are appropriately tracked and monitored to prevent diversion. Similarly, comprehensive home care guidelines are set for the development of treatment and therapy management services for assisted living residents. These policies and procedures must address how orders and prescriptions for treatments or therapies will be requested and received from healthcare providers, and how the facility will document that those orders are being followed, and how the treatment and therapies will be monitored and evaluated. In order to protect residents, the language sets strict guidelines for when and how facilities may terminate providing either housing or services to a resident. Terminations may only occur under certain specified conditions. If it is court-ordered, if the resident has engaged in a documented pattern of behavior that endangers the health and well-being of other residents or staff, if the resident is not paying and the facility has made reasonable efforts to accommodate temporary financial hardship, if the facility is closing or having their license restricted by MDH, or if the resident's needs, as determined by a healthcare professional, exceed the scope of what the facility agreed to provide in the contract, and if those needs cannot be met by reasonable accommodations or alternatives. Facilities are required to provide residents with 30 days advance notice of any terminations, and an appeals process is established. An exception to the 30 days requirement is established for specific emergencies. If a facility does terminate services, they have a requirement to develop a transition plan that includes the transfer to a safe location. A facility may not terminate services if, as a result of the termination, the resident will become homeless. MDH will survey these assisted living facilities on an annual basis and has the right to investigate complaints, issue correction orders, and assess fines. Fines are set based on the severity of the violation and begin at $500 for violations with the potential to have harmed the resident and climb to $5,000 plus $200 for each resident affected for a violation resulting in death or serious injury. A reconsideration and appeal process is established, similar to other licenses of this nature. In order to continue to encourage continued development of this assisted living industry, an innovation variance option is established. These variances may be granted to facilities that wish to allow services of a type or in a manner that don't match this licensure, but which will not adversely impact the health, safety, or welfare of the residents, and in fact is hoped to improve the services provided. The work group has been meeting these last months on resident quality of care and outcomes improvement will continue, and it, under this language, is transitioned into a full statutory task force. The group is charged with examining and making recommendations on how to apply proven safety and quality improvement practices in these care settings. Article 5 describes dementia care services. This establishes the additional requirements for those assisted living facilities that specifically offer dementia care. This includes additional training and standards around caring for those persons with dementia. Facilities that provide dementia care services are required to have specific plans to address how they will prevent wandering and elopement, as well as how they will monitor residents' behavioral symptoms. Direct care staff must be specifically trained in how to work with residents who have Alzheimer's disease and dementia, and staffing levels must be sufficient to meet the needs of residents. These facilities must also provide additional services to residents based on their specific needs and limitations. This includes assistance with activities of daily living, individualized nutrition plans, individualized activity plans reflecting the residents' preferences and needs, and the offer of support to family and other significant relationships. In conclusion, Mr. Chair and members, we've tried our best to craft this language to address concerns and feedback from all stakeholders, consumers and providers, and our colleague agencies alike. We are committed to continuing to work with them and with you to move forward and develop an assisted living licensure structure this year that can ensure the protection of our families and loved ones. Finally, while this framework for licensing assisted living facilities is critically important to fill an important regulatory gap in our state, we also know that the existing regulatory activities at MDH need to continue to be strengthened and improved. We've been working very hard over the last year to implement all the recommendations of the Office of the Legislative Auditor. We continue to do that. There is an additional proposal in the governor's budget to do just that, to both continue to improve on our operational capacity and as well as to put this new important policy change into place. We look forward to addressing the budget aspects of both of those proposals, current operational improvements, and the new regulatory framework with you in detail at the appropriate time. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner Malcolm. Other questions for this testifier? Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, thanks for your testimony, Jan, or Commissioner Malcolm. But it just, I think we can classify this as a major change, correct?
Mr. Malcolm.
Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen, yes, it is a major change.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Has this been evaluated in terms of how much cost would be increased at the local level in order to comply with all this?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunhagen, that is certainly a conversation that we've been having, and we know we need to keep our eye on striking the right balance. I have not heard any specific figures from folks within the industry who may be attempting to cost out the operational implications. We were very careful as we were crafting this language to do so, and I can assure you that the governor's budget proposal does reflect the cost within the operational entities and the regulatory entities for putting this into place. The cost impact on the provider system, I'm sure the folks from the provider community would be prepared to speak to that.
Representative.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, the you know, the concern I have is just that. We're going to be driving up costs and making it even more difficult for people to afford the assisted living. And, you know, I know we're trying to get at these complaints. Are we getting a large percentage of complaints out of this assisted living area currently? I mean, how many – do you have a percentage if we have, you know, how many thousand assisted living residents versus the number of complaints? Do we have any handle on that at all?
Commissioner Malcolm.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I'm sorry I don't have that number right in my head, but yes, we with some of the improvements we've made in the last year, we have much better handle on what the types of issues are and where they're coming from. I can get that back to you quickly.
Representative.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I would appreciate that. If you've got any idea of what the cost implication would be, because one, you know, the longer I'm up here, the more I realize when you advance licensure, okay, it's well intended, but then people just keep piling more and more requirements on it, and it keeps driving up the cost and makes, and actually what you get is a shortage and unaffordability out of it 9 times out of 10. And sometimes it can be used to build a fence to keep other providers out of the situation. So I'm not a big fan. And the last comment I would ask you to respond to, Wouldn't it be just as effective if assisted living people could just file a complaint with the department, and then if it was validated, it could be referred to local criminal prosecution rather than filing lawsuits and or threat of lawsuit or whatever, which is contained in Section 15?
Commissioner Malcolm.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenhagen, I think that's the system we've had in the past, I think, has been only reliant on after-the-fact complaints. And I think the legislative auditor in the report last March made it very clear that part of what they observed was the lack of clear enough upfront standards to make sure both that consumers know what they're getting and providers know what they're accountable to provide in these settings, which are indeed intended to be alternatives to nursing homes. And we're working very hard to try to strike that right balance with a level of regulation that is appropriate to the needs of the consumers as well as the capabilities of the providers. So I think we've learned that just relying on after-the-fact complaints is not robust enough protection for elders and vulnerable adults on the front end.
Just a final comment, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you. And I know your heart and intentions is good, okay? But I serve on the Ed Policy Committee, and we've had testimony from special ed teachers that they're spending more time filling out paperwork than they are with the student and their needs, okay? We go to our healthcare system, and we have surveys that were published in the Minneapolis Tribune where 53% of our doctors are burnt out, okay, much of it due to bureaucracy and, the filing. So just in when we promote and vet this, I just ask you to keep that in mind, is that, you can do more harm than good in terms of driving up the cost, creating excessive amount of paperwork, and actually taking time away from the needs of assisted living people, like we've seen in other areas of our state government, versus actually helping those people. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Schultz.
Thank you, Chair LaBird. So since 2010, complaints to the OFHC have increased by nearly 600%. So I think this is why this is such an important area that we need to do work on. And part of the governor's budget is to improve MARC and reporting upgrades. The rest is expenses related to this new licensure system, and then a report card and quality metrics to make sure that our most vulnerable are getting the highest quality care and that there's oversight. So it is it may be additional work on our providers, but the benefits we get from our vulnerable adults living in those facilities makes up for that cost, I hope. And if you think that there's a lot of overhead in terms of insurance and filing claims, I guess I've got a plan for you, Representative Grunhagen, that we can eliminate a lot of that paperwork.
Representative Keel is the next.
Can I respond to that, though? That was a response to my...
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for that input, Chair Schultz. But I would say that most of the paperwork by insurance companies are laws passed and regulations passed by the government, okay, that creates the mess. And secondly, I think, is there a state that utilizes this approach that has proven to reduce actual abuse, or is Minnesota being innovative here and we really don't have incriminating evidence that it actually works?
Chair Schultz or Commissioner Malcolm?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenhagen, as Chair Schultz mentioned in her introduction of the bill, Minnesota has been an outlier in the other direction. We are the only state that does not have a licensure standard for assisted living facilities. What we're working so hard to do in this bill is to carefully and quite specifically define what assisted living facilities are, and to calibrate the regulation accordingly. I do believe that some of the additional things that are in the bill, in addition to the licensure framework itself, the consumer protections, other investments in the governor's budget, as Chair Schultz mentioned, increased staffing for the ombudsman, for long-term care, improvements to our reporting system, this quality improvement task force. I think all of those are strategies that we fully intend to work collaboratively with all stakeholders to make sure that we are doing every bit that we can to work with communities to prevent these problems to begin with, not only to rely on sanctions after the fact, but to use all the information that comes through the system to work with providers and communities on prevention.
Representative Keel.
Mr. Chair, I think we have some more testifiers. I'd be glad to wait until we're done with those. Okay.
Very good. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Dan Pollack is the next person on my list. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, Dan Pollack, Department of Human Services, and I'll be brief because Commissioner Malcolm really covered a lot of it, and I really appreciate all the work she's done, and thank you to Chair Schultz for carrying the bill. I just wanted to reiterate on behalf of the Department of Human Services that there is a really authentic desire to get something done this year, and it's very encouraging to see how much progress is coming together on this session. You know, towards protecting and improving the lives of all vulnerable adults through this comprehensive approach to it. The ideas of the stakeholders are really coming to fruition, and I think there's a really good opportunity to overcome some of the differences that might still remain between House and Senate and Governor. On behalf of DHS, we're happy to see the package moving forward that will have critically important elements of a vulnerable adult reform effort, so a structure for assisted living licensure, electronic monitoring, preventing deceptive marketing, protections against retaliation, relocation, and termination, and expanding staffing for the Office of the Ombudsman for Long-Term Care. All of those are really vital. As the House continues its work, actually, Chair Schultz sort of preempted me on this. I hope you'll give due consideration to the DHS components of the governor's budget as they relate to vulnerable adult. Those are really important pieces, just as important as the policy is the funding. So we would like to see an assisted living report card move forward on behalf of 60,000 consumers and families. They would be able to provide us with that feedback and be able to see their responses included in the report card. The MARC Reporting Center for Vulnerable Adult Complaints does need some funding to make really critical infrastructure improvements, such as the 24/7 IT support, and providing for timely notification of 340 law enforcement agencies. Without additional GIS mapping, we aren't able to really connect to them in a timely way. And they also need help doing follow-up investigations and better data collection for safety and quality improvements. We are also, in the governor's budget, are providing grants to local counties and tribes to do adult protection services in a better way and look at suspected maltreatment allegations. And then lastly, as part of the Department of Health budget, the DHS would be building a jointly shared case management system to ensure that all the lead investigative agencies are working from the same SSIS system. Right now, DHS works on its case management system, MDH has its own case management, and those are disconnected. So there are a couple just pieces of feedback I wanted to give on the bill that's in front of this committee. DHS would like to ask that the bill prohibit the use of any types of restraints for any reason in these facilities. The use of restraints itself is a form of maltreatment. That's on page 40. We continue to have conversations. Actually, Commissioner Malcolm did a nice job of highlighting this, just about what the basic care facility level represents, whether licensure is the right level of regulation at that level. We had a long conversation on Friday with the whole stakeholder group about how elderly waiver, which is really meant to be an alternative to nursing home payment, whether that EW waiver and particularly the customized living component would pay for a basic care facility as it's envisioned. We don't feel that it would currently, and that would perhaps come as a surprise to consumers. So just needing some additional conversations about what we're going to do at that level. And then just a couple other minor things. We would ask that on page 11, the definition of maltreatment align with the Vulnerable Adult Act. And throughout the bill, there's a little bit of misplaced phrasing of MARC versus common entry point. The MARC is, should be referred to consistently throughout and should be the source of allegations of maltreatment. It shouldn't just be used for complaints about, things that don't rise to that level, minor level things. So that's kind of quick version. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Pollack. The next testifier on my list is Mary Jo George. And Jean Peters can come forward as well. Please state your name for the record and continue.
Excuse me. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mary Jo George. I'm the Associate State Director of AARP Minnesota, and I'm here on behalf of the Consumer Coalition, which includes AARP, Legal Aid, and Elder Voice Family Advocates. Preventing elder abuse is a top priority for our coalition, so we appreciate the opportunity to testify today, and we will limit our remarks to the licensing provisions, as we've already testified on the rights in a previous committee here. We'd like to thank, of course, Representative Schultz, who seems sick today, and so we hope you get better, for her continued leadership on this issue. And we want to thank, of course, Commissioner Malcolm and the Department of Human Services, and especially all the family members and the industry who are working together to find ways to protect older adults in both nursing home and assisted living facilities. I think, as Commissioner Malcolm said, this is a work in progress, this amendment, but it generally reflects sort of the consensus around a framework for licensure based on different care level needs and the requirement to license dementia care facilities. As you've already heard, Minnesota is an outlier from other states that do not license these facilities. And I think it's really important to note that today older Minnesotans living in these settings have much more complex needs compared to when they were first developed. And so we believe public oversight is not only critical, but it's really long overdue. So we really urge your support on that. Under this bill, as Commissioner Malcolm did a great job of highlighting, we support all the rulemaking authority to set a number of standards around safety and quality care in these settings. These standards include the need for appropriate staffing levels, staff training, the need for individual care assessments, as well as safety requirements and clear definitions and standards for dementia care services. Jean Peters will address some of these standards more specifically. But one of the other things that I think you have to understand is that we did agree with the industry that this framework does allow for flexibility for the industry to offer whatever services they feel are appropriate for them. It's just very important that we let residents and their family members know what these services are and what these services aren't. Because, again, today we've had so much confusion in the marketplace, and so we really hope that we'll take care of it. Briefly, two other comments. One is the strong support for a single contract for housing and services. This is really a serious problem where the care is very fragmented because it is provided by a number of entities. Some are management companies, some are the license holder, and there is no clear one responsible party who is accountable for the individual care plan. And so by having this accountability, families and vulnerable adults will know where to go to complain, and the care will be coordinated. And last but not least, we believe this bill begins to provide more public oversight of senior housing facilities that offer daily wellness checks and health monitoring services. Today, these critical services are not defined anywhere in statute, and it was an issue raised by the legislative auditor about the gaps in the regulatory oversight we have for these essential services. We think by regulating them, families will have peace of mind that when they place their parents in these facilities, that somebody is watching out, that they are indeed being provided. So with that, I will conclude my remarks and hand it over to Jean. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jean Peters, Vice President of Elder Voice Family Advocates, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to advocate for stronger laws and safer care for those vulnerable adults residing in assisted living and memory care facilities. I'd like to thank Representative Schultz, Commissioner Malcolm, and her staff and at MDH. They've done much to address not only our concerns, but those issues brought up by the legislative auditor's report that was issued just a year ago. We've made progress, and we will continue to work with all stakeholders to assure licensure of assisted living facilities. Many of you may not know, but my mom was in an assisted living facility, and repeated efforts to the administration went on deaf ears. She had medications stolen. She was left in her room, in her bed, for 16, 18, 19 hours at a time. Each time we let the facility know this happened, nothing was done because there are no protections. While this bill has many strong provisions, we urge the continuing strengthening of this bill in several areas, and we are turning to the lawmakers to implement consumer protections that help all vulnerable Minnesotans and their families. Today, most individuals and their families believe that they are entering into an agreement that this assisted living facility will help keep them safe as they age in place in their newly chosen home. We appreciate that the language in this bill calls for pre-assessments. As a nurse, I cannot emphasize enough the vital importance of a full and proper assessment by a registered nurse prior to move-in. This sets a standard for safe patient or resident-centered care. And prevention of elder abuse is an area we can all agree upon. We must strengthen our laws to prevent neglect and maltreatment. We must make certain to guarantee that all aides, assistants, and other members of a care team are adequately trained and competent in providing care before assuming the responsibilities for individuals who are vulnerable and at risk. After carefully making a choice, contracts are signed, time goes on, and aging in place occurs. Families then are stunned to learn that the $6,000, $7,000, $10,000 per month building or facility they have moved into may have only one individual on staff at night, and our legislation has permitted this level of care for many years. We urge continued work towards safe staffing standards and comprehensive training. The current standard of allowing a newly hired aide, including those with no experience at all, to provide care and learn on the job is unacceptable. The required 8 hours of training need only be completed within 160 hours. Of being on the job. With the majority of our caregivers working part-time, it is even more critical that we have comprehensive training, as months may pass before that requirement is met. Perhaps the resident who spent 51 days in the hospital following a simple foot soak with water so hot as to cause both feet to blister and the skin to slough off would have avoided this unimaginable trauma had the aide been well trained. Families and vulnerable adults are looking to our lawmakers to develop regulatory framework and strong consumer protections that keep older and vulnerable Minnesotans safe in their assisted living environment. Their lives depend on it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Peters. I invite now our next two testifiers to come forward, Toby Pearson and Carrie Thurlow. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Twice in one day. For the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow with Leading Age Minnesota here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. Mr. Chair, we want to say that, first we want to thank MDH and Commissioner Malcolm for convening really months-long stakeholder meetings on a variety of topics that have been raised both publicly and through the stakeholder process. The Long-Term Care Imperative has participated since last fall and throughout the winter, and indeed even weekly during this legislative session on a variety of issues. So the legislation in front of you reflects months-long work. And having said that, this bill is not yet a consensus bill. So there are many broad concepts in the bill that I'll go over that we do support. We cannot support the bill in its current form right now. The details matter, and we'll get into that a little bit here quickly. But through the stakeholder process, and as Commissioner Malcolm indicated, this was really an opportunity for all sides, consumer advocates, agency professionals in both DHS and MDH, as well as the Ombudsman's Office, providers, to come together and really understand this complex system that we have. And I think it's fair to say that we do have an emerging consensus on some really core values. First and foremost, that I think it's important that we recognize that we all agree that we should maintain a system that maintains choice and flexibility in assisted living. It's important that as we move towards a single licensure system and away from a kind of a two-contract licensed healthcare system, separate housing system, under one, and we're moving towards one umbrella, which we do support, that it's important to remember that these are home and community-based services. They are not institutions. We should not regulate them as such, and that there is a wide variety out there to meet a wide variety of consumer needs. Secondly, I think it's important to note that, excuse me, I'm having technology difficulties, Mr. Chair, that seniors should be able to live as independently as possible for as long as possible. Many assisted living settings do allow seniors to age in place, and we should permit that as much as possible and not create statutes that get in the way. Third, there are many perspectives that need to be considered as we work together to make sure that we have a system that balances safety and protection with choice and independence. Lastly, whatever laws we pass need to make sure that not only are we passing regulation, but appropriate enforcement with those regulations. I think that one of the key takeaways that we had last session is not only were there things that were happening that should have never happened, but there were enforcement gaps as well. So with that, I would also, just before I turn it over to Mr. Pearson, make sure that we want to state very clearly for the record the things that we do support in broad concept, and the details do matter. We do support a single licensure system to assisted living. We don't think we're quite there in this bill yet, but we do support movement towards that framework. We do support legislation that establishes the right to electronic monitoring for residents in both assisted living settings and nursing homes. We support strengthening laws around deceptive marketing and retaliation and consumer protections in that area. Again, we're not sure that House File 90 addresses all of our concerns, but we support that. And last but not least, we support clear, strong dementia care standards as well as regular surveys of assisted living settings that are done in a timely and routine manner. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer questions, but also want to turn over comments to Mr. Pearson to talk about some of our concerns with this particular version of the bill.
Thank you, Ms. Thurlow. Mr. Pearson.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson, Care Providers in Minnesota, today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. Again, I would like to thank both the Commissioner of Health as well as the Assistant Commissioner Pollack, as well as all the advocates for all the work we've been doing in the interim. I think it's been helpful. I think both sides have learned things from each other, but I would have to echo what Ms. Thurlow said in that we are not there yet. I would also like to thank Chair Schultz for carrying the bill and listening to us and having meetings with us. It's a very heavy lift, literally and figuratively, by the number of pages, and that we appreciate your work and continued work on this difficult topic. First, as we have said, we support moving an assisted living license. However, as Ms. Thurlow said, the details matter. There are many provisions brought forth by this bill which we support, which Ms. Thurlow discussed. However, for those provisions we find operationally challenging, we are hopeful there can be a resolution as it continues to move forward. We have the responsibility of identifying the potential for unintended consequences of the proposal, provisions where businesses could close because they cannot meet the standard or where their financing arrangements may be at risk, the provisions where results will be that consumers experiencing less access, less flexibility, and fewer services that they actually desire. First issue that we'd like to talk about is that the bill purports that we must take all payer sources. The provider concern is that this language incorrectly assumes that all providers are enrolled and eligible to accept all payment sources, including publicly funded programs such as Medicaid, as well as private insurance. It also does not consider whether the payment offered will be sufficient to cover the needed level of services. Currently, the elderly waiver program is severely underfunded by up to 25% below the cost of actually providing the services. Furthermore, clients on elderly waiver have budget caps that may limit the amount of services they can adequately receive. Second, we continue to have concerns with the lengthy, complicated appeals process for service terminations. The biggest concern is that there's the time frames for the hearing and the resolution of the hearings, that the assisted living must still take care of the persons who are in the appeal process. The assisted living establishment bears the burden of proof to establish the termination of housing or services is permissible. Potentially, this could delay the resolutions of situations that are unsafe. There is a big question of who will care for a resident that has initiated this process if a provider has already said we cannot provide the services they need. There's also concern that the new process is in addition to the current landlord-tenant law, and that there needs to be one single process for reconsideration. Potentially, under this language, a resident could pursue an appeal with the OAH, not prevail, and then turn around and file another claim in housing court. While we agree in concept with some form of appeal in the new licensure arena, the language still has too many problems for our folks. Overly broad definition of deceptive marketing and retaliation. While we agree in prohibiting deceptive marketing and retaliatory processes, we, the providers, are not opposed to greater protections, but with respect to deceptive marketing, it would apply to any misleading statements or representations by an employee. Recollections of verbal interactions are not reliable, which is why written contracts are used and utilized. Additionally, there are numerous existing state laws for consumer protection from deceptive marketing, including laws prohibiting false advertising and deceptive trade practices. With respect to retaliation, the language would apply to acts against a resident, employee, or person with a familial, personal, legal, or professional relationship with the patient resident, which is an overly broad universe. Under the language, the provider is presumed guilty of retaliation for any of a long list of actions taken within 90 days of an initial complaint. This would include an increase in necessary services if the resident's condition has changed. The discharge of a resident if their care needs exceed the provider's ability to administer said care, and would even potentially prevent the termination or discipline of acts of employees who self-report a maltreatment incident. The lengthy list of retaliatory actions does not take into account the frequent changes in service needs for the senior population served in these settings. Several of the actions considered retaliatory could actually put seniors at greater risk for maltreatment. Inviting more lawsuits when no quantifiable damages occur. Our provider concern is that the current language invites more lawsuits where there is no quantifiable damages that have occurred, and that plaintiffs who have suffered actual personal damages have the right to sue to exercise that right. If you've suffered damages, you can currently sue for them. If you haven't suffered damages, this goes too far. Lack of right to privacy in electronic monitoring has been restated previously. Much of the language has been agreed upon, with the exception of the notice of the monitoring. Whether the facility should receive notice of the placement of the electronic monitoring device, we believe that the provider should be notified for electronic monitoring devices to help carry out their duty to protect the privacy and the dignity of the residents. Overall, the bill appears essentially to apply assisted living into nursing facility laws, oversight, language, all that kind of stuff that all the consumers that you talk to say, we don't want to go to nursing homes, we want to go to assisted livings. The more we look to create more like nursing home-like environments, the less we'll have freedom to perform actions within these facilities that the consumers want. We support licensure but want to ensure that we are not simply creating new nursing homes. Any licensure framework should continue to promote consumer choice and access and person-centered care. We have specific concerns regarding the increases in fees and fines and the interactions of those with costs to consumers. Also, we'd like to mention that currently, under the new proposal, we will most likely lose a number of good providers because of the business relationships and the complex interactions with corporate entities that currently exist, which doesn't mean that we don't need to move towards one individual corporation that is held responsible, but that the current law would apply overly broad to current systems that folks have with management contracts. Easy for me to say. Finally, we pledge our support to continue meeting with the authors and the advocates to work towards a consensus on as many issues as possible. It's our hope that this process will allow for open dialogue and resolution of the different perspectives through negotiations, and that there will be final legislation on older adult protections signed into law this year. Again, thank you to everybody who's worked within these areas. It's been a lot of work in the interim, a lot of work up till now, and we appreciate everybody's continued dialogue on these topics.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. I have one more name on my list for testifiers, Beth McMullen. You'd come forward. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Beth McMullen. I'm Vice President of Government Affairs for the Alzheimer's Association, Minnesota North Dakota Chapter. I appreciate the opportunity to speak today on House File 90. Specifically, I'm going to focus on the licensing article amendment that you adopted. I want to thank Representative Schultz for her continued commitment to improving safety and quality of care in long-term care facilities. Among the Alzheimer's Association state policy priorities are a couple of areas central to the discussion today. Building a dementia-capable workforce, enhancing the quality of care in our residential settings, and protecting people living with dementia from abuse, neglect, and maltreatment. The attention to these priorities is reflected in the bill before you today. Just a reminder that last fall when the commissioner called together the various work groups, the Dementia Standards Work Group identified three general high-level recommendations to guide the recommendations that we ultimately put forward. And those are, one, people living with Alzheimer's disease and other dementias should not be required to reside in any particular type of setting. There should be additional license or certification requirements, i.e. minimum standards, for those facilities who are calling themselves memory care or dementia care. And then third, since people with dementia, living with dementia, could live in any setting, we need to ensure that all assisted living settings meet a minimum dementia training requirements. And I'm happy to say that these recommendations are in the language before you today. We understand that this is a major change in Minnesota law, and it increases the level of regulation of these businesses. The Alzheimer's Association, it's one of our key priorities that we want to ensure that people living with dementia and their caregivers, oftentimes who might want to live with them, have access to high-quality care in that living setting of their choice. So that is a part of the discussion that we've been having in these work groups, is how do we make that delicate balance work? We will continue to work with all of the stakeholders to address some of the outstanding issues that are out there, but I do believe that we can come to consensus, and we will have a great great buildup bring forward eventually, and this is we feel very good about where we are here today. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. McMullen. Are there testifiers from the audience who would like to say anything? Seeing none, discussion, and Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate going through this again. This is really important, and I want people to understand that all the work that's been done since the report, and well before the report, actually, I believe we were hearing some things earlier about abuse of vulnerable adults. And I would want to remind everyone again, this is everyone 18 and older. All kinds of different housing services. So think about your neighborhood group homes, and I know they're all regulated a little differently, but it's really important to think about what we're doing here and how complicated it is. I am a little disappointed when I read through the bill. We did a lot of work with the OLA, the Office of Legislative Auditor. There's very little that the OLA recommended that is in this bill. There are some things. I do see that. I would be concerned that the electronic case management system that was so important for people reporting to the OHFC needs to be taken care of, that needs to really address any issues. I think it's gotten better. When I read the reports, I see that it's gotten, there's less reports, but that's really, really important that happens, that function is working. Certainly, assisted living licensure is important. But what concerns me, and I think we heard it from some testifiers, is we are painting an assisted living close to a nursing home. And the idea behind assisted living is to make sure that residents have a choice. That is what this is all about, a choice. I can think about the gentleman who is elderly, goes to my church. I see him every Sunday. He's a little concerned about the fact that he got rid of his bike, so he can't bike to church, but he lives in a group home, and he is making choices. And I asked him, I said, how are you gonna do that without your bike? I don't know, he said. I'm not sure what I'm going to do. But I'm guessing that I know some people that will stop and pick him up on their way, and there is other ways to get there. But, you know, I asked him, how are you doing with your choice in housing? He likes it. He likes his individuality. I think he would be very frustrated if we told him that he had to do some changing, and I that is important. So, but there are some other things. I believe somebody brought up the fact that there's nothing recommending wellness checks. That's a wonderful thing to do for assisted living. When my mother-in-law lived in assisted living, they had something as simple as the door. There was a little hang tag on her door. No one had to stop by and say, hey, how are you doing today? Or you didn't show up for breakfast, where are you at? She wanted that independence. All she had to do was open up her door, flip the card, and the nurses, somebody walked by every day and said, oh, I see she's been up, or she didn't flip her card yet. And sometimes she forgot. And so they would knock on the door and they'd say, Mrs. Keel, you okay today? And, oh, yep, I just forgot. But one day, her neighbor lady didn't flip the card. And when they opened the door, they discovered that she had fallen a little bit ago and broke her hip, and they got her help right away. But it was a simple way for her to be independent. And that's what I want to stress here, is that we make sure we're independent, we provide independence. There was a suggestion about county or assessments when we put family make choices to go into assisted living. Nursing homes are already required to do that. But I don't believe it's a nursing service that does it. My experience has been somebody from the county social services comes in, says, yes, this works for that person or not. And we have a lot of requirements already for people that are need to move into some kind of care beyond nursing homes or beyond, leaving the hospital and needing some kind of assistance. But so Representative Chair Schultz, I was going to say Olson for a minute. I'm looking at her and she's busy reading. When I look at some of this licensure, the Board of Examiners is combined with the nursing homes. And I'm thinking, is that a good idea? Should we really have something a little different? I realize that we're talking about expanding, I would guess, cost. But I'm just wondering if it's a good idea to have examiners doing both of those things, and are they going to get confused?
Chair Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Lippert and Representative Keel. So the responsibility for the Board of Nursing Home Examiners is to make sure that we have qualified individuals working in long-term care. And a lot of the curriculum that they require in training covers long-term care services. So I think it is appropriate to have them look at licensure for assisted living facilities as well. And in regards to your previous comment about group residential homes, if you look at line 530, it defines basic care facilities, and then it goes on to look at what it does not include on line 6.1 through 6.32.
Chair Schultz, I think, are you speaking about the amendment in particular?
I'm sorry, yeah, the 813 amendment.
The 813 amendment.
Oh. So it's very specific to the type of assisted living facilities and the type of services they offer for that licensure of basic care services. And that services you can find on page 7 of the A13 amendment.
Thank you. I have three other representatives on the list, so just remind us that we have about 7 minutes left of our scheduled time. Representative Mason.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. This is just a comment. I was visiting someone in senior housing recently, and there was an incident that disturbed me because to me it was a matter of respect and privacy. And certainly safety should be paramount, and we're talking about that, but somebody had also mentioned like quality of care. So I think my thought is when we are training people to, again, we're dealing with a population that needs help. There's no question that many of them need help. But it still should be done with a respect, in a respectful manner, and in some cases paying attention to privacy. That's all. I didn't mention it, but it made an impression on me, this particular interaction.
Thank you, Representative Mason. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess mine is more just a comment, too. Or I appreciate Representative Schultz carrying this. And I know that this has been hard for a lot of folks, and a lot of folks have put in a lot of time into this. And if it was easy, it would be done already. You know, that we're doing meaningful work here. And I actually have to say, in tracking this over the last few years, that I really appreciate that we've moved beyond just the OLA report and the needs for systems and talking about things after they've happened. And I think we're having a very serious conversation. I think this bill, I don't know how many stops you've had to make with it, Representative Schultz, but you've been, it's been a long haul. And it's really shifting the focus of who our laws are, we're writing with them in mind, which is the consumer. And I think when you try to shift things in a different direction, it's hard. And I think it should be hard because those are the exact people we're set up to protect, is the consumers and the families as well. And I think that's a big piece of it. And to Representative Keel's point, you know, I think this bill does a lot of, it doesn't change. Again, I think part of what we've been hearing, too, is that we're going to change or take away choice, or we're going to make this more like a nursing home. And I keep going back to even the thing about the idea of the door knock, you know, that people could check. I mean, what we're talking about is making sure people can have that. If they choose to move into a facility and want to have a wellness check, that they know that they're paying for it and they're going to get it. That we have deceptive marketing practices to make sure that if your family's going to spend money on the things that a facility says they're going to do, that they're going to provide it. So I don't really see the argument about choice. I think it allows people to have choice and make sure that what they're going to do is going to be delivered. And I think this legislation, you know, has more work to be done, but I think the spirit of what it's trying to do is deliver good services for consumers to make sure they're safe, their families can feel good about the places. It's going to be hard, and it's going to shift the way we've done things in the past, and I really appreciate Representative Schultz navigating these waters to make sure we get to that place, though. Just more of a comment, but I'm glad to see where this is going.
Representative Cleborn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And to just piggyback on what Representative Olson just said, the problem that I think many of us are dealing with in our communities is that while people who work and operate in the care community understand expectations and they understand what is required and what is not required, the general consumer who is facing caring for a senior for the very first time in their life has no idea of the storyboard. And so to be able to provide a clear pathway for consumers and families to understand what exactly is and is not provided for is something that is very important for good care and for making good quality choices. So I, too, would like to
to recognize Representative Schultz for bringing this effort forward, and for all of the people who are committed, whether you're a care provider, a family member who has struggled through caring for an aging parent, as I have, and many of the stories that we have heard in our community. This last week, I learned of a senior who had fallen in her assisted care facility, and while she was wearing a button normally around her neck, where it fell and the way she broke a bone in her body, she was not able to press her emergency button. But for the good neighbor downstairs who had a son visiting, who heard the thud in the room above and then went and knocked on all of the doors to see where the accident occurred, and where this woman had left her door unlocked, was she able to receive care? So there are many things that we need to take into consideration when we're looking for safe choices for our family members. And I think this provides a start of a very good roadmap for our families. So thank you to everyone who has participated in this process. And I look forward to the ongoing conversations as to how we can make it better. Thank you.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I also want to appreciate Chair Schultz bringing it forward off the OLA report, because obviously it's an area that needs to be vetted from time to time. And but I do, does Mr. Berg, does he know when a fiscal note will be available? I see he's smiling.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, that depends on when the final amendments get added to the bill.
Okay.
There is, I believe, in addition to this one, I believe there's at least one more coming.
Mr. Chair?
Mr.
Do we know what the cost estimate is approximately right now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, the governor's recommendations were in the neighborhood of, for both departments, are in the neighborhood of $31.6 million in 2021 and about $21 million in the tails, but the bill has undergone some revisions since then.
Okay.
Representative.
Yeah, just one other area. My understanding is we're going to be mandating staffing levels in this bill. And I do, you know, having been on the school board and also involved in health care, that's a super local supervisory right. I have a hard time usurping that one size fits all right across the board with a varied amount of different services that are offered in the state. I think we got to be really careful on that, because you're just going to drive up cost exponentially, and those providers that are marginal or just barely above water right now, this could put them under and actually close up shop and provide less services. The other thing, one final comment, I got 22 seconds left. I don't think any bill we pass here is going to eliminate human error, okay? I mean, whether it's hot water for feet or whatever, those things do happen, no matter how well-intended, no matter how much training. I think to the degree that if we've had a 600% increase in complaints, how many of those are actually verified would be of interest to me. And, you know, quite frankly, I had an aunt who I love greatly. She is very good to me, especially when I was younger. And she wound up in assisted living, but she did have a little bit of a complainy attitude, you know what I mean? And I could see, and God rest her soul, she's passed away now. But, you know, there are those people that can make complaints just because it creates interest or meaning for them or something like that. And I think we got to be careful in that area, just as a final comment, okay?
Thank you, Representative. And before I pass it to Chair Schultz, I'll just say very quickly, as a pastor who walks with family members who are dealing with these sorts of transitions, I see regularly family members who are confused about the sort of care that they expected to be receiving, and also are finding very quickly that they're in a setting that's not appropriate for the care that they need. And so I think this bill is a good step forward, and I want to thank Chair Schultz for bringing it to us. So Chair Schultz, final comments?
I want to thank all the members for their work, and Representative Olson and Representative Keel for working on this last session. I mean, it is very difficult to navigate the long-term care needs of loved ones, and what the people of Minnesota desperately want is assurance that their loved ones are being cared for adequately, and that's what this bill intends to do. So I'm open to feedback from members. I would like to have bipartisan support. This is moving through the Senate,
And Senator Housley has adopted many of the content that's in House File 90 and the amendment, and we're working closely with the Senate to get this through. And so the goal is to get this to conference committee and pass as a standalone bill.
So, Chair Schultz renews the motion. Chair Schultz renews her motion that House File 90, as amended, be referred to Health and Human Services Finance. Okay. So all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
Aye.
Motion carries.
I just want to make one more comment. I would really be mad at myself if I didn't thank Ms. Clarkvist for working on the amendments and the language and working with our advocates and drafting amendments and staying late many nights here. Some of these amendments are larger than the underlying bill, so thank you, Ms. Clarkvist.
So before we adjourn, members, please note, hold the time on Friday, March 29th at 9 a.m. in room 10. And just pay attention to your schedule. Staff will confirm whether this hearing is taking place. So just pay attention to that time. But with that, meeting is adjourned.